Welcome, everyone, to the AdDot podcast. I'm really excited today to have with me Mark Wardle. He's in England, and he is the Chief Clinical Information Officer at his organization. I'll let you let Mark tell us more about that and what he does there. So welcome, Mark, to the program.
Thank you, Vaughan. Thank you for having me. I've been really looking forward to speaking with you.
It's a real pleasure to have you here. One of my motivations is just being the fact that I'm interested in healthcare from the standpoint of how can we actually benefit the patient, right? And although that should be the case in just about every medical practice, and I think largely it is, but also there's the challenge of, you know, how does the organization make money and, you know, deal with the expenses of running clinics, let's say, and so forth, versus, you know, how do we treat the patient the best that we can? And I think there's a very important set of trade-offs there. But, you know, I think maybe Mark has a lot to say about how the patient can benefit more. And I think that's a lot of what you are into. So if you could just tell us more about your background, that would be a great way to get started.
Thanks, Vaughan. Yeah, I still do direct care. I'm a consultant neurologist, so I'll deal with neurological emergencies, and I've got clinics looking after patients with things like motor neurone disease and Parkinson's disease, epilepsy, multiple sclerosis. So, you know, I see firsthand, A, some of the problems, and B, that the potential for technology to improve and transform health and care. But my digital role, so I do that part-time, and as Chief Clinical Information Officer, I'm kind of part of the wider digital team within the organization. So I provide clinical input for the digital teams, and I work to represent digital to those clinical teams that are all across my organization. So, I mean, the current priority I've got at the moment is we're about to deploy an electronic prescribing system. So, you know, in many respects, we're a bit behind many organizations worldwide in terms of our maturity in digital. But that's what we're trying to do now. And, you know, the whole idea of it is to improve the quality and safety of patient care. I'm quite privileged in that I've got a few different roles. So I do some research as well. So I get involved in data and academic work, mainly using real life data. So data acquired during the processes of care to try to improve that care and to learn more about diseases and conditions and prognosis and epidemiology. And so I think that puts me in an interesting place to see all sides of the problem.
It's a great position to be in, and I, you know, it's really nice to have your experience to draw from. And if you could tell us a little bit more about your background in terms of digital and software, how did you kind of get started in that, being that you're definitely on the medical side?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I started out with a Commodore 64 and started learning BASIC and assembly language. And then when I got to medical school, I realized I could make use of the computer science library as well as the medical school library. And so I remember borrowing the very slim K&R book and learning C then. And we had these big Unix mainframes. And so I'd log into one of those and write code in the evenings and try and balance that with my medical work. And therefore I always kind of really loved technology and its kind of ability to improve people's lives. So I'm glad I did medicine, but I'm glad I'm involved in technology too. So, and then as a postgrad, I mean, it was quite difficult actually doing medical training and trying to keep up with technology, but I tended to gravitate towards things that would allow me to use digital and data. So when I got the opportunity to do a doctorate, for example, I made that a very data heavy piece of research, taking patient data and whatnot, and running analysis and learning R and different approaches to writing code. So it kind of opened my eyes to the options in healthcare for digital. And so then I decided to learn Java and started writing a kind of patient-facing and clinician-facing application to try and capture data as part of that. And that was great fun. Because of course, you know, there's if you're the user as well as the writer, there's no mismatch. You are the user, and so you get none of the lost in translation problems that are often seen when users say what they think they want and then are upset or disappointed when a development team gives them something that they didn't really ask for or need.
So you're saying you dog-fooded?
Absolutely. And I think, yeah. And so when there's a problem or if there's an issue, you know, that gets you. And so that opens your eyes to trying to make also very reliable and well-proven code so that it's really deterministic. And so like over the years, then I realized that every time I had something that had lots of mutable state or lots of complexity, and it was normally of my own, you know, design in many respects, it was like a foot gun for you, isn't it? And so I rapidly learned not to do that again, just for my own sanity.
Yeah, very interesting. I see here too in your notes that you moved to the Amiga from the Commodore 64 at some point. And that's actually one thing that I really, if I have a regret about a path that I didn't go down, was with the Amiga, because it supported C programming language, as I recall, and it had a GUI that was, I mean, I would say roughly competing with the Mac, you know, maybe not quite as Mac-ish as the Mac, but, you know, and it wasn't an expensive machine. You didn't go spend $3,000 or whatever it was at the time for a Mac, this tiny little box that, instead, I don't know, what was it, maybe $1,000 or less or something like that. I mean, it was very affordable. And I couldn't get to the point where I felt like I had the time to do that. I was mostly working on Unix, you know, big Unix. Big. It was, you know, VAX 11780s, you know, mini computer, but much bigger than PCs, but also with PCs. And so IBM was just like the place to be. And I don't even recall how much business software was developed on the Amiga. Was it much, Mark?
No, I don't think so. There was some classic ray tracing software, which got very popular. So it got used a lot in graphic design, and it was for games. But I was of an age where games was perfect. And actually, the interesting thing was the hardware, and it had some interesting co-processors. So, I mean, the 68000 chip was really lovely to write an assembler. And you could, I remember, I think it was called DevPack, the C package that I got for it. And it had a debugger, and you could run through your code. That was the assembler. And then... The graphical user interface was good, but you could get right down to the metal. I mean, it didn't have a memory management unit, so you could really write all over memory whichever process you were in. But you could even write and hook into the coprocessor that did all of the display. So you could add parallax graphics just in one shot, because you could have part of the screen going very slowly, and then closer to at the bottom, you'd have that scrolling much more quickly. And that was really hard to do with, you know, other computers. So it was a fun time, actually.
Yeah, I have to tell you just a little bit about my background with games. You know, of course, I was growing up in the era of, I would say late in the pinball machine era. And so my friends liked to play pinball. And then a little bit later on were games like Space Invaders, Galaxia, I think it was called. And was it the one asteroid, some kind of asteroid game where you sat in the middle and these asteroids were like moving toward you or something. You tried to shoot them to before they, you know, crushed you or something. And I just never really enjoyed those very much. Even the pinball machines, I did it. I played them mostly because my friends liked to play them. So I remember one evening I was out with one of these friends, and he was really good at whatever it was, Space Invaders or something that he was playing. And I just really didn't care, but I blew through $25, you know, and this was back in the, let's say, like early 80s. I was still pretty young, and I was like, ouch, you know, like that, you know, and that just sort of cured me. It was like, I just really don't enjoy this. And I just like spent like equivalent of today, like $100 or something on just this waste of time. And it just never interested me. And so when this goes forward to the Amiga now, and I was like, okay, so what business software can I develop on the Amiga? Right. And that's, I think that may have been mostly the thing that, as I recall now, is that because strangely enough, as a very young person, I was just interested in business software. Isn't that kind of weird? It's just weird, right? Because
it's perhaps maturity is the
I don't know the
better way of putting it.
I don't know. Maybe it was just like understanding I can make money here and I can lose money over here.
Yeah.
You know. So anyway, yeah. But I'm glad you enjoyed games. That's probably a healthier route overall. Probably helped with your imagination and cognitive, you know, capabilities and stuff. So.
But I guess it's interesting because you hear nowadays about people learning to code. And I saw just recently there was someone advocating for, you know, not starting these high level languages, but going back down to kind of lower level metal kind of things or C. And there was an argument about whether C was, you know, low enough level.
C is low enough for today. So I mean, my goodness, you know, like seriously.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Ridiculous discussions you see on X. But yeah. But you kind of do, I think, appreciate then your mental model of computation, I think, is aided by some time spent kind of in the weeds of how computers work. And I don't think that's a bad thing when you're trying to optimize something or try and understand what's going on behind the scenes, even when you're working in a very high-level language. So I don't really regret any of that. I think it was quite fun. I mean, I think it's all formative, I think is possibly the best way of putting it.
Yeah. I, you know, in terms of assembly or assembler language, I did use, 8086 assembler, you know, I guess maybe 8088. I don't know if there was really a distinction between those two. I don't think there was, right? You could still access half registers or full registers on either chip. But anyway, I used it just enough. I learned assembler in school, but then on the PC, I used it just enough for the things that had to perform, like accessing screen memory and, you know, any keyboard or mouse interactions, things like that, which eventually you could do using C libraries. But there was always that sort of just little call overhead that I didn't like, you know, that sort of extra little call overhead. So I would go ahead and write, you know, some ASM files. And I had some products that were based on, you know, screen keyboard, basically GUIs or character UIs, right? But sort of like GUIs. And so that's where my interest in, you know, I used assembler where I needed to, but I think you're absolutely correct, is understanding machines at that level, right? Understanding computer architectures, hardware architectures is really important. I would say the one thing that I haven't really gotten into more recently is the more modern hardware architectures as far as memory access is concerned, because back even on, you know, well, the PC and then even the Unix, most of the Unix machines were all flat memory spaces, right? Mm-hmm. And as I understand it now, they're not really like that, where you basically address you know, from zero up to some, you know, FFFFF kind of, you know, memory space, that things work differently now. And I don't think it's just virtual. I think that the machines are actually like that, but still, you know, I still have these sort of mental models, like you said, of how the machine works. And, even now with like, what is it? Different levels of cash and, you know, the overhead of going out to main memory and things like that. I do keep that in mind, although a lot of times, I'm not working in areas where that can really be controlled, or, you know, even if you can control it, is the trade-off of going to that level of, you know, memory access and false sharing across, you know, different cache levels and things like that, level one, level two, level various levels of cache. I'm not sure that those are things that I can often do much about, but you can find libraries, right? Like in Java,
I guess
the Agrona libraries for handling things like that. Those are pretty cool.
I guess you're right, actually, because I suppose if people were starting out now and were faced with processors that are not as deterministic as those old ones, because they aren't now, are they? They kind of do all kinds of weird branching stuff and optimizations. And actually, maybe if I tried to learn anything nowadays that low level, I'd be saying, oh my goodness, I don't know anything about any of this, because the simpler processors back in the day, I mean, you could write better assembler than your C compiler back in those days. Whereas I think that's not the case now, is it? I mean, I think that presumably compilers nowadays, and certainly, I mean, you know, the just-in-time compilation can run rings around what you might have expected. So I think maybe you're right. I think maybe it's quite hard for people starting out now because we are all working at higher levels of abstraction, but most of us are quite glad to be working at those higher levels of abstraction. Yeah. But it's interesting.
Yeah, I think, it's good to understand. If younger folks get a chance to learn it, I think it's important to learn it. It can benefit them. I remember just optimizing some code that, you know, I was working with some folks that, you know, were newly using Java and had been doing programming like in Lotus 1-2-3 or something, like, you know, which is just miles apart in terms of levels of abstraction, and they didn't understand simple sorting techniques and, you know, binary search and things like that that can just greatly enhance performance, and they're not really difficult to do, but you just have to be aware of them and that you can do it. And even breaking out of loops, like after, you know, after you find something at the 100th element, even if you're just going sequentially through, you know, like, okay, you want to return or break out of that loop rather than going through all 50,000 of those, and you know, where you basically have this linear overhead constantly of whenever you hit this algorithm. So I think people would do well just to understand that it doesn't come for free anytime, right? It's just it's never free. So probably maybe a little bit too much reminiscing here, but I enjoy it. So then, technology and business, how do you think that technology has transformed business services, how they operate, and how does that overlap into healthcare technology?
I think in many industries, things have become really disrupted by technology. And we've seen, you know, what was the Mark Andreessen quote, where, you know, software is eating the world. But actually, I look at some industries with envy, because actually I don't think that is actually the case in health and care. I think that in general, we do our work despite the systems that we've got and not because of them. And I think there are lots of reasons for that. And partly, I think it reflects a lack of modern approaches to kind of architecture and modern approaches to the way that the wider system, in inverted commas, is designed. I mean, I think I listened to a podcast by you on banking, and you realize that there are incumbents that are hoping to transform. And, you know, you see the new entrants of modern banks who have basically placed technology at the heart of their new operations. And it's mainly, you know, about giving customers a really fantastic experience, and they are agile enough and have the technology stack, a modern technology stack that can flex and adapt to those requirements. And then I look back to health and care, and you think, oh my goodness, because really what we have in health and care is systems that are predominantly about the administration or billing of health and healthcare. So, you know, you naturally then end up with a slightly broken marketplace where everything feels, for both probably the medic, but also for the patient themselves and their families, carers and whatnot, that everything is rather fragmented. Everything seems to be very siloed. And I think that things like domain-driven design are a really big lever, set of approaches and a set of ways of thinking to kind of disrupt and really step back and reimagine that, really. And I guess the way things have developed isn't due to anybody's particular fault. And I think you see this in other industries, is that when you have systems that have evolved over a long period of time that have had paper as their core process, a core part of their process, that defines how organizations are structured. It defines the interactions between those organizational units. I mean, it's Conway's law all the way through in general. And technology should be allowing us to break those molds. But I think our architectures, certainly in healthcare, are all about applications. They're all about the vendor, and they're all about the organizations. So straight away, you see that the architecture is not modularized by the domain. And it's a really complex and adaptive domain. And, you know, we need to be modularizing according to the subdomains of our wider health domain. And the trouble is that healthcare in the future and now, but particularly in the future, has huge numbers of challenges. So we've got hugely aging populations, ever increasing demands on healthcare, the resources in all countries to supply healthcare is going up and up all the time. So how do you meet that challenge? Well, there's something about having the right technology in play so that you can put health outcomes at the heart of what you do, so you can really push the value-based health agenda. There's so much in healthcare that we do that actually is a very low value. There's a lot of transactional healthcare that actually doesn't really do anything. And so if we are able to focus and improve the efficiency of what we do, improve the processes, reduce the number of redundant steps within healthcare, but also just stop doing things that are bad for people and do the best things that are shown or proven or help to prove what does work for patients, then that's where we should be placing our efforts. And I don't think there's necessarily a problem of private healthcare versus the public healthcare. I think it's probably a more fundamental thing than who pays for healthcare. I think it's a cultural challenge and also a kind of socio-technical challenge. And I think domain-driven design has a lot to help in fixing some of the problems that we've got.
Yeah, that's a lot to think about. I just a few things that I came to mind as you were talking. You know, first of all, you quoted software's eating the world, and I think while that's true, a lot of organizations still haven't figured out that that's happening or has happened, right? And continues to happen. And so you think about, you know, I mean, just to name some digital banks, but digital banks, these new banks that are purely digital, right? They are working from the premise that they are software companies, right? Yes. They are software companies. And that is a recognition that software is eating the world. And I really do think that what's going to happen, based on traditional banks that I've worked with that do use software, they have software, they develop software, but they are so stuck in what they have been doing for 50 years, 40 years, even, you know, whatever it is, right up until today, that they've just built on top of these things that they've continued to do. And it just keeps getting less and less performant, more brittle. And they still haven't figured out that they're software development companies, right? And I really do believe what's going to happen is that these newer digital banks are just going to eventually, they're going to acquire those companies for their customers, right? They will, because they are going to own the industry, and these traditional banks, and I think there are very few exceptions to this. I do think that probably, you know, JP Morgan Chase is an exception to that. No, they're going to acquire, if anything, they'll acquire the digital banks or whatever, but they are actually, at least apparently, and I have not worked with JP Morgan Chase, but to me, it just appears that they are on top of it, right? And Jamie Dimon is pushing that direction because he gets it, right? But there really aren't too many CEOs or CIOs or CTOs in these banks that really, really, truly get it. No. And if they do, they don't have enough voice, you know, they don't have a big enough voice or influence to actually change the way things are done. Yeah.
But what's frustrating is that that's not just a thing of making less money than they could be making. It actually is visible as a customer, isn't it? So that when the systems just don't work quite right and you don't get the result as quickly as you'd expect.
Or they just crash and they're down for hours, right? Nobody can get to their money. Nobody can deposit. Nobody can withdraw. Nobody can do anything. They can't use their credit cards.
It's not just about internal bank. It's all about their customer experience. And I completely agree. And I guess that the challenge for healthcare is that, what are the things that are coming, right? Well, we've got ambient sensors. We've got monitoring in the home. We saw that with COVID with, you know, being able to potentially monitor people who don't really need hospital care, but you know, they need monitoring in their own homes. And what are the technologies that you need for that? And you need hospitals without walls. So, you know, you're blurring the distinction between being in hospital and being at home. But then there's things like precision medicine. I mean, at the moment we do a few different blood tests. If I'm starting you on, say, azathioprine, I might check your ability to metabolize that drug, and I won't use it if you can't metabolize it well. But in the future, we're just going to have absolutely tons of data. And how do we make sense of that data to improve the way that we deliver care? And that requires amazing tools to make sense of data. And the old approach, I don't think he's going to scale to that, and that's the challenge for healthcare is the legacy systems are not up to the job that we need.
Yeah, and I think, you know, based on comments about banks, for example, okay, how can patients actually be helped more? And there's something, you know, just something I became more aware of probably 7-8 years ago, when, not that I wasn't aware of it in general, but the actual name for this, they call it behavior and sentiment, right? Patient behavior, patient sentiment. And what, how do they behave with regard to the medical care that they are supposed to use? And a lot of this even has to do, like what you said, in home, right? Like, let's say kidney dialysis. Now, I mean, it has been the case for several years now that kidney dialysis machines can be in home. They have these rather portable, you know, compared to the big old machines that weigh whatever, 700 pounds, you know, several hundred, not 700, but maybe 700. I don't know. I've never lifted one, but they're big, right? And even when they're sort of streamlined looking, they're still heavy. But now you can just wheel one into a home. It's maybe, you know, a few feet by, whatever, right? And okay, now this is really convenient, but with the person, will they connect to the dialysis machine when they should, on whatever periodicity that they should be? Or, and when they do, how do they feel about it? What is their, do they feel chained to this? Do they feel like it's life-changing, like as in I can be alive because of this, and I can have a better, more enjoyable life? Or is it just a drudgery for them? And how does that affect the overall care, right? Are they actually declining in health because of the way they feel about this, even if they are keeping up with, right, the actual treatment? And do you have any general comment on that, or specific?
I think that's all about patient activation and shared decision making, and patients who feel vested, who feel that they are listened to. That shared decision making. I mean, people think that we always have all the answers, but I think in healthcare we actually don't really. I mean, often our practice is based on historical practices, and actually there are lots of points where there is equipoise, where actually we don't know whether to do A or B. And so that uncertainty, there's a tremendous uncertainty, which A, we should be researching and enrolling people, but also B, sharing that uncertainty with patients. So the more that patients understand and are able to influence a decision, and it's often a case just as in technology, where there'll always be a trade-off in your decision. In medicine, there's a trade-off. You know, do you want to take this treatment, but I may cause you to have bone marrow suppression, but it may improve your symptoms. And so, how do you inform the patient? How do you have a conversation with your patient? Making sense of data for the clinician, but also making sense of data for that patient. So I think the best way of engaging patients is through really compelling communication, and that will have to be tailored. And that's the future, I think, is humans here will need to be involved always, because there'll be a translation to be made to help patients understand their condition, the uncertainty around any decisions, the options that are available to them. And I think that when you approach healthcare like that, and maybe our digital tools should be helping support that shared decision-making, bringing the evidence together and showing what might happen or the outcome of that patient compared to a cohort of peers, for example, which we've done in things like multiple sclerosis, then you think, well, actually, maybe that's the healthcare of the future. It's supporting communication, but through the use of data and evidence. I don't think the communication will ever become less important. It's an absolutely vital part of shared decision making.
Right, and you know, I think about, you know, just the advances in technology, to what extent can technology currently read even like people's mood or, you know, I really don't know the fact about this, but there must be sort of some brain activity that occurs under situations and where you could examine, you know, how, I guess through empirical data, how does this person feel right now? And what is this doing to their heart rate, for example, or what is this doing to their, whatever it is, you know, adrenaline or something. And, you know, you don't want those things spiking during a treatment, especially, right? You don't want someone being upset as they're getting a blood draw because that is going to change the reading, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think that we, you know, I'm a big advocate for digital and data, but I think that that human connection of understanding how the patient is feeling is most important. But perhaps I'm just not with the times of monitoring ambient feelings. I mean, I think I could be persuaded very strongly that monitoring your pulse and blood pressure and the kind of those endpoints during any kind of intervention is very sound, and if we can do that in a compelling way, that's great. I think maybe the most important thing is just to ask people, I mean, what is important to you as a human being? And when you're having those kinds of heart-to-heart conversations with patients, for example, at the end of life, or, you know, actually that's the human connection of, and there won't be a right answer for all patients. That patient there may want this doing, would prefer this. Another patient may have different preferences about their end of life care, for example. And so I think the health service needs to be able to deal with all of that complexity. But clinicians need to be freed up from the humdrum of the routine. So I sometimes think of medicine sometimes as driving off road, I guess, you know. So as a senior clinician, I guess I would expect to go off road quite a lot, because that's why I'm an expert in neurology. But a lot of the work that we do should actually be running on rails, and it should be systematized, and there should be processes for the routine of healthcare. But instead, actually, I think what you'll find is that pretty much all of us are driving off road pretty much all the time. And I think that probably explains a lot.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting way to refer to it. And it's good that you're, you know, open about that. That's, I think, laudable that you're simply saying, we're not really sure, right? I mean, where are we in this? I think the thing, though, like, I'll just talk about my own parents. I lost both of my parents in the past, between, you know, a little over 2 years and a year and a half now, my mother first and then my father. But what I found in my father's behavior toward medical care is that he would give doctors the answer he thought that they wanted to hear. But what if they could actually see that for whatever reason, he just didn't want to answer their question. But if they were just able to say, well, now, Mr. Vernon, what if, or whatever, you know, maybe they call him by his first name or something, but, you know, like now, but if they just had a way of seeing that and then could get him to admit it, because I might be sitting next to him in the exam and I know what the answer is, but I don't want to embarrass my father, and I don't want to, or maybe I'll sit back and go like shake my head no, as the doctor can't, you know, is listening and, you know, whatever it is. But
yeah,
you know, but what if someone has to pick my father up because I'm not available and they have to drive him there? They're not going to know those kinds of things. And I'll tell you, continuity of care, all you have to do is just send your parent to the doctor once, right? One time without you. And it's they could be off, talk about rails, they could be off the rails for a year and a half. And I saw that literally with my wife's father, that we were away, he had to go in to see a doctor, and some misunderstandings occurred because of a friend taking him there completely, right? They were speaking like without our, like, in other words, we didn't give them permission to do this, but they thought they were being helpful. But we didn't even understand this until more than a year later, when finally this doctor like is sort of irritated at my wife saying, but you shouldn't feel this. And she goes, what are you talking about? I don't feel like that. Well, we have on the record, and she looks at the date and she realizes that it was a time when we were away. You know what I'm saying? Like these things happen in real life. Totally. What can we do? Like, okay, so is my father-in-law going to die or become very ill because he wasn't getting the care over a misunderstanding? You know what I'm saying? It's just, this is real stuff. It's
absolutely. Yeah. And why, you know, patients again and again report that continuity of care is one of the most important things that they want. And so, you know, you can do that through seeing the same clinician. And we used to have that in the United Kingdom with our general practitioners, but that's been eroded over time with a shortage of GPs. And so it's really quite difficult to get that continuity through simple individuals. So I would again say, you know, why are our tools not helping to provide that continuity of care? And so when you look at electronic health records, the reports from clinicians are that they generally hate them. I mean, they do their work despite of them. Their usability scores are atrocious. They copy and paste lots of information. It's impenetrable. It's a medical record. It records things. But is it a tool? Is it a tool for work? Is it a tool for pushing the envelope of medical work? Is it a tool for continuity? I'd argue not. I mean, I think that some of these products were built 30, 40 years ago. And so, you know, they are the incumbents. They're big commercial vendors, and there's a lock-in, but they're not necessarily built around the human doctor professional interaction with patient, carer, family. They're not meeting the requirements of that health service, as your anecdote, as your experience has demonstrated. I would say.
Very true. Well, I want to pause on that for a little while, because I think we'll come back to that topic in a few minutes. But okay, I think one of the ways that I learned about you was I saw that you had blogged about and tweeted, and there were still tweets, now it's ex posting, right? you basically made public that you have this insight into using domain-driven design in healthcare. And that is where I said, I'm going to follow this doctor, you know, this chief clinical officer and, you know, information officer, whatever. And so I did, and we've been in contact and, you know, absolutely, a little bit here and there. But I want to know, how has domain-driven design changed your way of thinking and how you work in healthcare with software?
Yeah, great. Thank you. Well, I stood up at a health IT conference in Wales with the Eric Evans Blue Book, and tried to get everybody to read domain-driven design.
Interesting. How did that go?
Complexity. It didn't go well, I have to say. I guess my experience had come through trying to write my own software, really, in healthcare, in which I realised that it's got so many different complexities and so many different interactions that I, even working in healthcare, couldn't manage it in one go.
And it felt to me that it gave me a useful set of principle. It's more of a kind of set of concepts, isn't it, rather than like a didactic list of you will do A, B, and C. And it just struck such a chord to me because I realized that, you know, for example, some of the accidental complexity we have in health and care just in my local region was that we have this very application-centric approach in which we take an application and we've bought it and now we've got to integrate it. But there's no sense of a common subdomain of, say, for example, patient identity. And so what happens is that you end up with this ossified, glued together, closely coupled, bespoke, proprietary gluing together of different systems, which, you know, in that system over there, there's an API, brilliant, but it uses M and F to code gender. But there's a system over here using an entirely different set of codes. And you know, this is just something very simple. If you're starting to try and integrate something more complicated, that's really much more difficult. And so I realized that if I started to think about healthcare through the prism of a different set of boundaries and recognize that there are boundaries, you know, but that's not based on I work in an acute facility and there's community over there, or you're using a system from one vendor and I'm using a system from another vendor. Because all you realize is that each of these generally has like all of the internal subdomains managed in a proprietary way, glued together inside them. And then all they're doing is exposing, if they're exposing anything, some standards and interoperability on the outside of their systems. And so you think, well, actually, you've got tight coupling, you've got a lack of modularity, and none of this is organized along the boundaries of our domain. And so what can domain-driven design do for us? Well, it pushes us to understand how to decouple the systems that should be decoupled, about the importance of technical standards to help us decouple those, providing contracts between those. And it gives us that shared language because, you know, you'd be in a room with clinicians who want what feels like to be a single system, and then you'll be behind the scenes with digital where actually we're not talking the same language at all because we're all talking about different things and the vendors all have a different concept of what X or Y is. So it felt to me that this was an absolute wake-up call, that is this something that if we did correctly gives us a way to get rid of some of the complexity that we've given ourselves through the way that we've purchased systems and designed systems for the future, and potentially give us the tools, give us the principles to which we should be building the tools of healthcare for the future. And I think that it does. And I think that the simple recognition that some of our components adapt and change at different speeds should tell us where you need to make those cuts. So the whole concept of you as a person and your identity, you know, that's something that is totally foundational. If we can't link to that record and plug things onto that and understand that's you, we're lost. Of course, you realize in lots of places that doesn't exist. You know, if you were a patient, you might have to have a registration in that system over there and a registration in that system over there. And if I'm a staff member, My sense of identity is likely not to exist in that system versus that system. And so simple examples like I should like, as a maybe I'm a trainee and I'd like to count up how many appendectomies I've done over the last 3 years if I was a surgeon, but I've been in that facility and that facility. Actually answering such simple things, very difficult if you haven't nailed down common models, common semantics. And so things like staff index, patient index, you can see right at the base, they're things that really should be commodities, should be available to all. But then there'll be things that in healthcare are changing very rapidly. And so those kinds of components need to be able to adapt and flex or be designed in a way that they can cope with changing clinical practice. And so just the art of medicine should inform the architecture and the structure of our software and data services that underpin our healthcare systems. So I think that the light bulb moment was putting the domain at the heart of this. And, you know, if you understand the domain and hopefully understand the technology, that's a good place to be.
And not, you know, just the wording of things, but the language itself, right? In other words, you are speaking a very specific language with patient identity versus something else. Have those things helped you directly? The pure fact that you have language differences across subdomains?
Absolutely. Because if you don't have that, then we have exactly the situation we have now where we're agonizing and building different software systems to manage the risk of a patient not having a registration here or having a duplicate registration in that system compared to that system, and then not having, for example, an electronic prescription available to them because we've sent them the wrong identifier. And so some of this we're a victim of our legacy here. And so some of it is about what we would do in the future, but it also gives us a prism through which to understand where our problems lie and where the solutions therefore might lie in the future. And it feels to me that's important. So one of my other roles is I chair our technical standards board within NHS Wales. And one of the things there is, you know, how can you use or set technical standards to inform procurement, but also open that dialogue with the commercial sector to say, well, actually, this is where we aim to be in 1, 2 to 5 years' time. And naturally, it feels that having a domain-driven approach to those standards makes it much more tractable because you focus on the things, because you can't solve it all overnight. So you focus on the things that are most important and foundational first, and it allows you to therefore prioritize those kind of core foundations. So having the same sense of what that patient identity is will allow us in the future to say, well, actually, if you're procuring a system now, we would expect you to, you know, and these are the technical standards to which we work. Having that prism of DDD through which we can understand where we are and where we need to be really helps us sequence that.
Nice. And I see you have a note here about William Kent and his book, Data and Reality, and this sort of real life model. How does that contrast with or even overlap with domain-driven design? How does that help?
Yeah,
you?
I think that's right. I mean, I think that there will be things that within the ecosystem, within healthcare, that we all agree on and are, you know, very straightforward. Except there's often something not that very straightforward when you actually dig under the details of it. But then there'll be other things in which actually trying to come up with a unified model that works for everybody doesn't work. And so, you know, case in point that we'll have real life clinical data, which is often extremely complex, almost fractal in its kind of approach, where you have kind of an episode of care with multiple encounters, those encounters with lots of different people. It can get very complex. And of course, when you're in research, you want access, you want to use data, but you don't necessarily want all that complexity. And so there's something about projections. So projecting that very complex data into something that's much simpler or different. So for the case in point for me was trying to aggregate outcome data for multiple sclerosis for post-marketing pharmacovigilance to try to measure outcomes for certain types of multiple sclerosis drugs. And so what you need to do is take data from multiple centres, which are hopefully in similar formats or at least have the same semantics, and combine them. And the future, I think, will be composable data because we've nailed our semantics. But that real life data is much too complicated. And for the purposes of analytics and for the purposes of this specific project, we needed rectangular projections with definitions of what we thought of as, I don't know, comorbidities like autoimmune disease. And so it makes you realize that this wasn't a special case. This wasn't something that, you know, is unique. This is something that we have to do all the time. And I think of it as a specific example of a more general requirement, which is making sense of data. And so do we have those tools? No, we don't. And what's frustrating is that we have a domain at the moment that is split by purpose. So your applications will be written, in clinical applications will be written in .NET or Java, and they'll have some, perhaps they'll have some analytics capability, and perhaps they'll have some transformation capability to try to make sense of data, but it's usually very anemic. We'll have different systems which aggregate data and put them into a warehouse, and we'll do analytics on that. And then we'll have totally different set of systems, totally different set of models for doing research, when in fact they're all different facets, different sides of the same coin. And so then you realise that actually what we've missed here, I mean, it's a cultural thing, really. If that's being written in Java or .NET or C# or whatever, and we've got our analytics written, done in R or Python, and research probably done in, or some proprietary thing, and then research done in R and Python, that trying to share the tools between those arbitrary domains is really difficult. And so what have we done wrong here? It's because we're not putting the transformation, the sense-making of health data for whatever purpose, whether it's in aggregate, whether it's for direct care, or whether it's for research, they're not a commodity. And so, you know, it's akin to anybody starting out in healthcare, if they want to break into the market or they want to do some analysis, you've got nothing. It's really hard. You start with having to write your own networking stack, basically. Whereas, you know, modern technology, you've got stratum of different libraries and frameworks that allow you to focus on where you can add value. But in healthcare, we're so far behind that we don't have a suite of data and digital services that allow us to compose them together and to build upon, because it's often locked behind proprietary walls. So I think that's a real challenge.
Yeah, that's a lot to just process in my mind. I'm sure everyone who listens.
Sorry, Vaughan.
No, not at all. It's we need to hear this. I'm just saying that. Where do you start? Right. It's. Yeah. Okay. So now you've used domain-driven design. Has that helped you with your patient care application, or maybe that work was done earlier and you didn't have the benefit of DDD back then, or tell us about that. But your patient care application that you developed, what is that about, and how has it been shaped?
Yeah, thanks, Vaughan. Yeah, I mean, I think domain-driven design definitely helped me understand and break it down into chunks. So, you know, that concept of I knew I needed, you know, patient identity, and it needed because I'm a hobbyist programmer, really. So mostly it had to sit in a niche between different systems, and so it would always have to chat and interoperate with other systems within the wider ecosystem. So whether it was about patient identity, or whether it was about staff identity, or management of documents or referrals and that kind of thing, I had to break it apart like that to make sense of it, and I had to break it apart just to be able to build it in any kind of sensible way. I mean, I made a lot of mistakes in the first version. I used a really very nice rapid application development system from Apple called Apple Web Objects, which they had. It was designed originally by Next, the Steve Jobs Next, and then it was brought back into the Apple fold when Steve Jobs returned. And it was originally an Objective-C framework, and so it had an object relational mapper, so you could talk to databases. And they built iTunes using it, and I used it for this patient application. And so it allowed me to really go quite quickly, developing basically web pages, server-side rendering, connect to a database, connect to other systems within the network. And that got me so far, and it took over for, you know, our research registries and tracking patients and their outcomes. And it allowed us to record real-life data at the point of care. And then, for example, if you had multiple sclerosis, we could plot your progress over time and then superimposed upon that. And very rapidly, it could draw all a cohort of patients with the same characteristics as you, so that you'd be able to see how you were performing compared to people with similar problems. And so that was really helpful, and it allowed us to track, you know, drugs and treatments and how the effects of those treatments. And so that taught me a lot. But what I realized then was I had a problem, because although it was very modular in the way I had constructed it, it was a monolithic application. And I guess I was a victim of my own success in a way, because people kept coming to me and saying, oh, can we use it for this? And sometimes that worked fine if it was a similar set of requirements. But then I started getting people asking, well, could we use it for this, but we want to use it in this hospital, and we want to de-identify patients because we want to use it for purely research, and we want to do this and that. And I realized then that I couldn't deconstruct the system and make it adaptable and flexible to all these changing needs. What I really needed to do was break it apart along the seams that already existed, but do it better, and then recompose these different services, which abstracted away a lot of the complexity of integrating with that system or that system, and just made it very simple. So I could sit there and go, right, we're going to need this, 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 this. And so that's what I've been working on most recently, is breaking it all apart, spinning out individual components, making them open source in general, and then recomposing them for what I need. And it's been so much better. So, for example, within health and care, we've got a terminology system called SNOMED CT, which is an enormous catalogue or an ontology of diagnoses. So given some codes, I can make sense of that. I can understand that, multiple sclerosis is a type of demyelinating disease, and make all kinds of inferences about things just on the basis of the data. And I originally had that as part of patient care, the application. But then when I wanted to have a research pipeline, so we take loads of data from lots of different places, and I'd want to make use of that service, because it was an individual component, but not very it was kind of part and parcel of application. I couldn't really reuse it in lots of different places. Whereas now I can simply just compose these services together, so that if somebody comes and says, we've got this data streaming in here, we want to transform it, process it, we're going to send it up to the cloud, we'll process it there, then bring it back, or whatever we want to do, actually I can compose these services together to meet the requirements. And I think that would be the future, because I think that these kinds of things should become a commodity, that we should be actually working at a much higher level of abstraction. We shouldn't be getting commercial vendors to be working in such low-level things. We shouldn't be differentiating commercial vendors on the basis of their use of standards. That would be like saying, I'm going to choose Apple rather than Microsoft because they've got TCP/IP. I mean, you know, it's a given that we have ubiquitous networking. So why don't we have these ubiquitous services across healthcare? But the challenge then will be for the vendors to be giving us higher value, higher abstractions, and probably focusing on things like those outcomes that we were talking about and shared decision making. And improving healthcare rather than simply being record systems.
You're thinking.
So I think I've learned a lot from doing that, but I've still got a long way to go.
Well, I see a couple of things there. You ran into the situation of innovators and early adopters, and you had trouble crossing the chasm. And then you figured out, okay, I will have innovators and early adopters, and I still want to cross the chasm, so let's think in systems. Yeah,
absolutely.
I think that's absolutely kind of your journey, that you started realizing, oh, this is not just an application or a program; it's a system.
Absolutely, yeah, a multifaceted system made up of individual components. Totally.
So, tell me, is WebObjects from Apple, was that open source? And in general, how has open source benefited healthcare?
Well, it was one of the problems, actually, because WebObjects was deprecated by Apple. And there was a lovely little open source community that built some frameworks around it. And it was an interesting framework in that you could add open source tools around it so that you could replace the internals. It was a fairly dynamic framework, which I think belied its Objective-C roots, which is obviously a very dynamic language. Whereas they turned it into a Java application, so it had some idiosyncrasies as it moved to Java, but yeah, Apple deprecated it, which made it a really difficult platform to continue to develop, and they didn't open source it, which I think was probably the nail in the coffin for it. And in many ways it was ahead of its time, but in many ways it was a thing of its time. You know, it was the time where you had these things like WebLogic and BEA stuff, you know, big application servers that you would deploy your application within and it would manage it. And I think that's quite old fashioned now. So I think the role of open source now in healthcare is that we should be building as open source commodity services that kind of disrupt and transform healthcare, and really throw down the gauntlet, throw down a challenge to the existing vendors to really raise their game. I don't think open source has really got hold yet in healthcare, but I think there are some interesting developments, and I think that, you know, in the olden days, to build, I don't know, a form, a graphical user interface, I mean, some of this was quite hard, I suppose. So the vendors back in the day would allow
in-house developers to use their EPR product to build forms and build applications on top of their EPR. Their EPR, I guess, became a platform. So you'd leverage the platform services of that EPR. But modern tech, I guess, teaches us that, you know, actually building forms is very easy nowadays. You can do it in anything you want, really. And I think that, you know, that point of differentiation, a push towards open technical standards, I think open source will have its day in healthcare. But I think it's probably quite a long journey, and there's a long way to go.
Yeah, definitely a pity that we can't just use that today. I think maybe it's just the expertise, right? When you look at open source, what is it? It's a lot of technical libraries, frameworks, whatever you want to call them. And these are helping developers at a very, you know, sort of low level, maybe not quite low level, but where are the programmers, right, going to learn the expertise? Can they, you know, get on a call with Mark Wardle at 9 p.m. his time in Wales and say, okay, Mark, let's walk through this. How are we going to do this open source tool for, you know, it? There's a big disconnect there. And where are you going to find the doctors who are willing to do that, or even have the energy? Maybe it's will, right? Will there, one thing is the will, the other is the ability, you know, like just literally the time and strength, human, you know, limitations are going to weigh in a lot there. And I can only imagine that doctors are just exhausted, right? At the end of a day, it's like, wow, I've been listening to all these problems and I've been trying to help, and you know, you're going to need patient sentiment, you know, behavior and sentiment yourself, right? It's just how can we help the doctors now, right? So,
but I guess I'm not necessarily advocating for doctors to be coders. I mean, I think there's a real it's really important that we get professionals, doctors, nurses, physio, whatever the discipline, to be involved in the conception and the design of technology, and around the technology in the domain.
Yeah, that's what I'm referring to, though, is that the doctors, nurses
got involved.
They would be domain experts, right? So now I'm a programmer. I'm working with the domain experts. How do we develop this in open source? So
You know, I see what you mean.
Because I can just go and start developing some technical thing on my, you know, with my own thoughts. But if I want to apply that to medical, how many ways could I get that wrong? Well, countless ways, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are regulatory issues as well. And, you know, the future will be, you know, we need to get some of this absolutely rock solid. So no, you're absolutely right. But I did naively think several years ago that the big technology companies, the likes of Microsoft and Google and Amazon, would sweep into the healthcare market and disrupt it using this kind of approach. But I've been disappointed, and then disappointed again and again, because their efforts in healthcare have actually been really quite disappointing. And I think there's something really difficult about the healthcare market in terms of, like, how do you pay for this kind of stuff? And how do you pay for the time of professionals to be involved?
Well, I will say this. These companies have, you know, it's one of the most open secrets on Earth that Google is a monopoly, right? And they just blow money on things just to, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be critical, but really it's sort of like openly trying to hide their monopoly. And so they work on these other things that don't really matter to them, but they did try a healthcare record. And when I saw that, I was like, wow, this is great, or it could be really bad. And then they shut it down. I don't even know why, right? Do you know why?
I don't think it got traction.
Yeah. So, but that but in a sense, okay, it didn't get traction, but why not? This is Google, right? And I just think that there are enough companies with, you know, like, okay, Microsoft is going to put, what, $100 billion into AI over, I don't even remember the years and the what, probably 5 years or less. Or okay, so where's the $1 billion to help people with AI, right? Using AI within healthcare, right?
Yeah, and it, absolutely.
But are they, you know, is the technological overhead so great that just creating the tools is so time consuming and financially consuming that they just can't get there, you know, at the same time? I don't know.
It's fascinating. I mean, did you hear about IBM Watson, Watson Health?
Well, no, I guess I didn't, or maybe I've forgotten. Go ahead.
No, it's I mean, Watson Health was, you know, like, here's some AI. We'll consume the patient data. We'll consume the evidence from PubMed, all the published literature, and we'll put it together for you. And that was the sales pitch. And I remember seeing a booth at a health IT conference, you know, where the Watson Health team were there. But, you know, it has since been either shuttered or sold off. And I think there were several reasons for that. But I don't think the performance was as was expected, and it didn't get the usage that it expected. So I just don't think they got the results. So I think this is a genuinely hard problem. Microsoft had a similar thing to Google with a personal health vault, but I think that was shuttered as well. So I think it is an interesting domain, but you know, the future, if you want access to health data, if you want to build models that can process health data and make inferences from that health data, you know, actually, probably large language models are not the right thing for that, but I'm sure there will be technologies coming soon that will allow us to have, you know, better decision-making in healthcare. You know, where does that data come from? Who's collecting it? And where are the tools that are going to do that, collect that data in an unbiased and useful way that's going to be useful for those models? But I guess the challenge, of course, will be, you'll need to monitor that. So, you know, you need to monitor the outcomes of those models. You need to monitor the effectiveness of those models and the decision-making to make sure that you've got that governance wrap. You've got to make sure they're safe. They're going to be medical devices. There's going to be regulatory approval. And I would go back to the case that even if we did have huge investments in AI in healthcare from technology incumbents, actually the very systems and processes that you need to manage an AI entity doing healthcare or supporting healthcare are actually the same systems and processes that I need as a human being. Because if I'm seeing you in my clinic, I need to know that, A, have I made the right decisions? What are your outcomes compared to my other patients, my peers? You know, actually, comes down to using technology to build learning health and care systems. And that's where we should be, whether it's for humans or for artificial intelligence in the future.
Yeah. And I guess this is where then I said, let's pause on the patient behavior and sentiment, or that sort of, you know, holistic care of the patient through data and algorithms. Now we're here. And I suppose, you know, we've already discussed this perhaps thoroughly in that there are no answers right now, but, you know, what is the future of information technology and healthcare in general, and how does AI weigh into that? Just maybe your own hopefulness, or maybe even overlapped with reality, right? Kind of merged in with reality.
I just think this, so much tremendous scope in managing this. I mean, I think even just simple processes of orchestration,
the management of clinical pathways and the number of ridiculous manual steps that are required to orchestrate even something quite straightforward. So, I don't know, say you're coming in for heart surgery and you're going to need in sequence or maybe out of sequence, maybe it's fine in parallel, maybe they need to be serially organized. We need, prehabilitation, echocardiogram, x-rays, maybe a CT angio, excise test, whatever it is. And then you have your surgery and then there's a bunch of other things that you need. Just even the basics from an information technology perspective of making stuff better. You know, other industries have used process mapping and that kind of technology, not even getting into machine learning and AI to kind of compose different things. I often feel in healthcare we're like a conductor, and really we need to be conductors or composers of what is a symphonic orchestra. Is it the different aspects of a symphonic orchestra, the ensemble, the different sections need to be working in playing in tune with one another, but they are independent. And so do we have the tools and systems and processes that make that better? No, we don't. And information technology could fix that very easily. Reducing the number of steps, reducing redundancy, you know, reducing the number of times you get called to an appointment on the same day in three different departments. It's just a nonsense. But then you think, well, actually, if we start to measure value and outcomes and we've got tools that allow us to capture that at the point of care, that allow us to communicate outside of the traditional, you know, come to my clinic, you know, actually, I'm now monitoring you, Vaughan, via your step count, and I'm measuring the efficacy of your Parkinson's drugs or your whatever drugs it is for angina, and I'm measuring how many steps you're managing each day. And there's too much noise there. There's a lot of data there, but I put that together with genomic data, and our machine should be identifying the signals in the noise there that are meaningful. So how do you work that? So systems that continually improve and assess, and then we do the right thing by you as a patient, for example, or as a group of patients, so that we manage our services better, or that we recruit you into clinical research trials and are continually improving our understanding of medicine and how we manage patients. So I think there's an enormous optimism. But it somehow feels that how we meet those challenges, I think there's a big gap at the moment between the tools that we have and our ambitions for the future. And I think that technology, the tools that we need to raise their game to meet that challenge. So I'm always an optimist that we can do this. But I think it's a challenge. I mean, I think What you see in algorithms, so as a general thing, you know, say you've got atrial fibrillation and irregular heartbeat, then I at the moment have a set of heuristics or a set of rules, a decision aid almost, to decide whether you need to be on an anticoagulant, a blood thinner. And so how has that algorithm been developed? Well, that algorithm was developed through research, so they would have looked at patients who had atrial fibrillation, looked at the outcomes of those patients, built a tool that said which ones did badly and which ones, you know, had a stroke, and which ones did okay. Look at the criteria for that and built a rough and ready heuristic. So if you're younger, if you have a structurally normal heart, then that decision aid may say you just go on aspirin. Depending on the characteristics, you may end up on anticoagulation. So the cycle, and there's something about the learning cycle where that data, the outcomes, the decision aid, the heuristics, the modification of that, because it needed research and then it was published and discussed and then gets turned into recommendations for clinical practice, that can take decades. And so it does feel that if we do our job right, then in the future, our processes, our systems, our decisions could be monitored, tracked, and improved with a much faster iterative cycle. And that's what I'm trying to get at with this concept of a learning health and care system. It's that speed of iteration that I think that technology can allow us to develop. But it means breaking apart health and care into its component parts before recomposing them and putting data at the foundation of that. And I think that would be the magical place to be.
That is, that sounds excellent. I really don't know how to even add anything to that. I did have a couple ideas, though, that came to mind during your interview. And just to kind of maybe wrap things up a bit, I know one thing that I'm really proud of is that this is, I think, the record-breaking longest podcast that I've recorded. This is excellent because this is a result of complete engagement in the conversation. This is really good. This is not like I'm saying, wait a minute, I only have 50 or 55 minutes for this is really important conversation to me. This is just the kind of thinking that needs to be propagated throughout. And I hope that we get just kajillion, listeners to this because it deserves it.
Oh, thank you, Vaughan.
But I just, I had this thought and I said, okay, how am I going to say this without putting Mark on the spot, maybe saying something that he doesn't feel comfortable in saying? But here's the deal, right? Okay, you're kind of confined to the environment that you're in, and you've got certain responsibilities and also things that you would like to change, but maybe you can't change for various reasons. Okay, now, what would you think if, let's say, someone like Mark Cuban? Mark Cuban, I know, has gotten into pharmaceutical, right? I don't know if you knew this, because obviously he's Mark Cuban. He's thinking about how he can make money, but he's also concerned about how much money people are paying for very expensive drugs, right? So he got in, I don't know if it's already been 2 years now, but he's like got a very, very experienced pharmaceuticals thinker and, I think doctor who works with him on this, okay, who helped him, with the startup. I don't even remember the name of it, but it's easy to find. Okay, so let's say someone like Mark Cuban says, wow, I heard this podcast by, what was that guy's name? Some weird name, Vaughn something or whatever. But he was talking to this really super intelligent, doctor who has vision about all these really cool ideas. And his name, I remember because I had to remember, it's Mark Wardle. And I'm going to contact Mark and I'm going to pay him like whatever he wants to do exactly what he wants to do. Now, so as I don't put you on the spot, we're in a string theory environment now, and we've just branched into one of the infinite numbers of strings that we possibly could. And here's Mark over here who isn't trying to lose his job chief clinical information officer in Wales, but he still is going to pursue what is clearly his passion. What would that Mark Wardle say to Mark Cuban? Like, would he say, okay, let's do that? Or would you say something like, it doesn't matter which string I'm in right now. I think I'm doing the best good where I am. I don't even, you can say anything you want to. I really don't. You know what I'm saying, though? I don't want you to feel on the spot at all, but if you had any opportunity in the whole world to pursue what you could possibly do, what would that be?
I guess I would love to disrupt the health IT market. And I think that there's something really interesting about, have you heard of Wardley mapping?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Ah, perfect, perfect. So Simon Wardley is no relation to mine. He's got a Y on the end of his name. But it's given me a great understanding of the kind of what he calls situational awareness, where you understand. I mean, that's part, I suppose, of breaking things apart and putting it back together again, is that what are the things that are a point of differentiation? And what are the things that should be foundational and ubiquitous and commodities? And it feels to me that there are some big things that can be done for the future in terms of providing foundations. And the trouble for any commercial entity is that goes against, the bottom line in many respects. So why would a commercial entity wish to invest time and money in things that other people will use? And I think so that's really hard. So that, but for me, part of trying to improve things overall, if there was a sense of kind of charity in terms of trying to, or actually taking the long view to disrupt a market, I could see those foundational building blocks would be a really interesting set of platform services. And I would couple work on those foundational services with the higher value stuff, which would be on the top left of a Wardley map, which are new or novel or poorly understood. And you'd want to you'd take a very different tack where you'd iterate very rapidly and you'd focus on things that are actually poorly understood in healthcare, like shared decision making and no code, low code environments, how you build systems and get clinicians really iterating very, you know, if you get somebody in and they're involved and then it's a year or 2 years down the line. But if you can speed up that cycle, that's a very interesting place, and patient facing things, that top left. And then in the middle of your Wardley map, you've got things that are not quite commodities, but are important kind of products in their own right. And you could see that a push towards greater use of technical standards, this push of trying to turn what we think of as the electronic patient record inside out. So rather than making the interoperability something that's external facing, but it's actually kind of a lingua franca, it kind of works between those different products so that you just compose them. They're the three planks there would be the three areas of focus that I would think would work well. And I do think there's a hard cultural issue with electronic patient records. So your big hospital systems will buy the incumbent. But I think that there are very, very many niches. The overlap with research, the overlap with analytics. You know, the idea that you've got analytics over there and then me in clinical practice, well, actually, when I'm seeing you, I need my analytics to see you. And I think those niches are probably the way in, but built on that suite of underlying services is how I would go.
Well, I think I'm gonna estimate. You know, I was just having a discussion about estimates that got kind of ugly on one platform. But it's all fun. Oh, did you? Yeah, that's all fun. But anyway, so I'm gonna estimate that I'm only roughly 17 levels of separation from Mark Cuban. So I'm certain that there's some way that he's gonna find out about this now, I don't know. Maybe 16. So that may have increased the chances. But anybody out there who knows Mark Cuban or someone who knows someone who knows someone who knows Mark Cuban, yeah, you know what to do next. Anyway, or someone, right, else.
Yeah.
Okay, one more idea that I had is, have you heard of Nick Toon?
No.
Oh, he's a DDD guy in London.
Yeah.
And he runs the London, or DDD London, or London DDD meetup. So here's a message to Nick. Nick Toon, I've put on my megaphone now, and okay, look, I know that Wales has a different football team than England, but I think the king used to be known as the Prince of Wales. So that, you know, we're in 2024, not 1524. So can you take care of Mark and make sure that he gets some time on the DDD meetup there? And yeah, anyway, you got it. You got the message, right, Nick? Just find a way to get in touch with Mark. And if you don't know how, I will introduce you. And that will be the next step in Mark's journey toward disrupting healthcare with domain-driven design and everything else that he sees. So how's that? Is that a good idea?
That is fantastic. Well, you're a gentleman. Thank you very much.
Well, it's been a real pleasure. And I'll tell you, I am going to promote this podcast like crazy. It is truly, to me, the most engaging. Well, I shouldn't say that because it's not fair to others, but it's at least the top, you know, podcast that I've had. And it's been such a pleasure.
I've really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it's been such a pleasure.
I've really enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Vaughan.
Okay, Mark. And take care. And and Mark is awake from, we started our conversation at 9 p.m. That is 2100 hours, right, for you Europeans and others. Now it's pushing 11 p.m., 2300. Can you get the drift, right? Mark is into this stuff. So please listen to him and let's help him do stuff. Okay. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Vaughan. See you soon.
Okay.
If you enjoyed this interview, please subscribe and stay tuned for more. This podcast is sponsored and produced by Kalele, makers of Domo Roboto and the Zoom platform. To learn more, visit kalele.io. That's kalele.io. Thanks for listening.